Hi, everyone. Before we get started today, I just wanted to remind you about our partnership with FEE, the Foundation for Economic Education. Are you between the ages of 14 and 26? I sure hope so. That's the age group I'd really like to have listening to this show. If the answer is yes, you are eligible to apply for FEE's three-day seminars. They are going to be held across the United States, and they are designed to teach young people like you the power of economic thinking. Because you never know. You might have been absent on the day that your public school or your college talked all about entrepreneurship in the Austrian School of Economics. FEE's three-day seminars offer opportunities to learn economic principles that can affect your career prospects, investment decisions, business strategies, and more. Seminar topics include economics of entrepreneurship and the economics of business success, and offer opportunities for young people to learn new methods of thinking that can help them pursue future passions. So if you are between the ages of 14 and 26, please think about this opportunity to join students, successful business leaders, and great teachers in the discovery of the relationship between personal and social wealth, as well as the virtues of an enterprising life. The total tuition cost for the three-day seminar is $79. That includes all meals and housing. Tuition and travel reimbursement scholarships are available. There is no charge to apply. Applications are reviewed and accepted on a rolling basis. Apply today at fee.org/students and make sure you let them know in your application that you heard about this opportunity through the School Sucks podcast.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Good day to you, and welcome to School Sucks Podcast, Productivity Month. This is our first theme month of 2016. This is our first theme month ever. All this month, we are going to be talking about productivity, organization, time management. How the f*** does that work? We're going to be revisiting some old favorite topics from the past, like Getting Things Done, that's David Allen's book. And of course, Evernote. If it wasn't for my discovery of Evernote, I would probably be in an insane asylum right now. Whew. So lots of great guests on the way. We're going to start with two shows with my friend Nathan Frazier, the creator of the Anarchopreneur podcast. And we're going to be talking about the importance of setting goals, clarifying goals, tracking goals. Our conversation extended 2 hours, so I'm going to split it into two parts. The second part will be along in just a couple of days, so be on the lookout for that. In fact, this show is more of an introduction to the goal-setting topic. It has a bit of a slow start. I want my audience to know who Nathan is. I want Nathan's audience to know who I am. And then the second show, we'll move into more specific goal-setting strategies and tips. And I really want to say thanks to everybody who's on board with School Sucks 4.0. It was so nice to see the positive feedback coming in to the group, and everybody who's already participating in SSP Productivity Month. That's hashtag SSP Productivity Month. If you have questions or comments or feedback or tips, please use that hashtag. That's SSP Productivity Month. Hashtag SSP Productivity Month. Thanks. It makes it easier in the future for me to gather all of the topics from January together and ultimately present it somewhere else like the website. Cha-cha. Now, a lot of content and conversations for this month is already planned, scheduled. Some of it's even recorded. But there is still room for a few additions and changes based on your feedback. Join our group. It's called the School Sucks Project on Facebook. Follow me on Twitter at School Sucks Show. And now here's the first part of two of our conversation on the topic of setting goals. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Time to introduce myself as B.L., the super chill, the kind lady daffodil. Here I go again. Is it inane or just the same? My life is on the brain with the grip up on the mic. Yeah, we doing it right. Original gangsters from Cleveland unite.
It is hard to be a gangster. With the basket on your bike, it is hard to be a gangster.
best with the basket on your bike. It is hard to be a gangster, gangster, with the basket on your bike. It is hard to be a gangster, 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 gangster.
So, Nathan Frazier, Happy New Year, and welcome to School Sucks for, I believe, the first time as a guest.
I'm super stoked to be here.
Now, a little history. I've been on your show before, Live Free FM. I think the first time we did an interview, I know, actually, the first time we did an interview was 2012. You had me on your show to talk about the Prussian education system, and people will recognize your voice. People who've listened closely for a long time, I should say, will recognize your voice because I worked that into this huge series called The American Way, which was kind of paralleling happenings in America in the 21st century to, good heavens, Nazi Germany in the 1930s. So our interview appears in the second episode, I think, in that series. But you, since then, have gone in an exciting new direction that I wanted to give you some time to talk about here at the beginning of the show. So first of all, what was Live Free FM? It still is in existence, but how has that evolved since people last heard your voice on my show?
Live Free FM is and always has been kind of a freedom-oriented show, and we've always been more about solutions than pointing fingers. Personally, myself, I've always been kind of an agorist and an entrepreneur at heart. I've never really been satisfied with the corporate 9-to-5 grind, and I've always had side hustles. And now I'm kind of going full in on my own personal company. Mm-hmm. And so I've rebranded Live Free FM a little bit, and I've started a new podcast called the Anarchopreneur Podcast. And actually, I have to give you credit for this. Multiple times I've heard you say this, and this is one of the things that I totally agree with you on, which is, we don't market liberty correctly. A lot of us do not understand marketing. A lot of people say, oh, I'm not a salesman, but we are. We're all trying to sell this idea of liberty to people. And not very many of us focus on effective selling techniques. And Anarchopreneur, the new direction that I'm taking Live Free FM in, is basically about that. It's about understanding sales, applying it to business, and applying it to activism.
Yeah, you know, I think you brought up a couple really interesting problems that I'm trying to solve and have been trying to solve. You know, the sales relationship that we're doing with people, and for my show, it's not just the philosophy of liberty, but it's also things like, you know, economics, philosophy in general, questions about the optimal way to raise and educate children, sweet Jesus. I mean, this is like basically trying to sell people lit fireworks, you know, from an emotional standpoint. But, you know, the other thing too about doing sales or seeing yourself as a salesman is, you know, for me, School Sucks just started as a hobby. So it's been very difficult in many ways to make that transition into operating this as a business and going all in to that endeavor. It does in a way, or I'm getting over it now, but for a long time, it did almost feel icky to me to say, okay, now this is something that this got too big to be a hobby. So now it has to be a business. And I'm still trying to fully embrace that. And that's why we're here today.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of people kind of have a negative connotation. They have this filter that they see sales as kind of slimy and greasy. We get this Scrooge McDuck, Montana Max idea of what salesmen are, or what capitalism is in general. And you get people that say, oh, you're not doing it for the movement. You're not doing it because you love it. You're doing it because you're trying to make a quick buck off of it. And the truth of the matter is, if you have something that can bring value to other people's lives, you have an obligation to figure out how you can effectively do that. And if it brings value to other people's lives, there shouldn't be a moral dilemma with accepting value back in order to fund the ability to continue doing that. So what you do on School Sucks, I find very valuable. And I know there's a lot of listeners out there that find it very valuable. And to think that you shouldn't be able to monetize it and you shouldn't be able to generate an income that sustains your living off of bringing such immense value to your listening audience. I know that a lot of us have this like emotional and internal conflict about it, but I think that that's really a self-destructive way to look at it. And I think that selling is a natural part of human nature. It's a natural part of being a human. It's something that we love to trade. We love to benefit each other's lives. And when somebody does have something of value, to shame them for trying to successfully fund their lifestyle off of providing that value, I think is very counterproductive. And I wish that more people in the Liberty movement would get over that hangup, because I think that we would be a lot more successful in our goals if we stopped having that self-defeating attitude about trying to make a living and being salesmen for Liberty.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that. And it's, you know, sometimes it's more of just this quiet voice. Like, you see other ways that people are trying to fund their projects. And I catch myself going, oh, I know what that is. Ooh, I hope I don't sound like that. And I remember a friend of mine, MK Lords, wrote this article maybe like 6 or 7 months ago. And I think she called it Libertarian Welfare Queens or something like that, about people who were trying to raise money basically in ways that she disagreed with. And I remember my first reaction was, oh my God, am I going to be mentioned in this article? You know, and fortunately, so obviously I wasn't going to be. Obviously, I'm trying to, you know, get value returned for value provided. I really, really believe that, despite some subtle hangups that I have. But yeah, there is still something there, this discomfort with this, that really needs to be confronted.
Yeah. And I think that there are wrong ways to do it, and there are correct ways to do it. And selling and monetizing, it's just like any other form of communication. I mean, the marketplace is a mass communication, and transactions, buying, selling, and trading, those are ways that we communicate what we find valuable to each other. So just like any other form of communication, there are bad points to it. You can cuss, and that doesn't completely negate the value of speech. Mm-hmm. You can use hateful words and run somebody down, but that doesn't mean that speech overall is a bad thing. So yes, there are people that try to monetize in ways that I disagree with, but that doesn't mean that monetizing your message in general is something that should be looked down upon or shamed.
Well, absolutely. And it gets to a point where it's a necessity to keep something going, because, you know, what I've always tried to communicate subtly at times and not so subtly at other times is, I know what my time is worth. I know the market value of my time in the world of fake education, you know, in the world of schooling, in the world of college consulting. It's worth a lot. Trying to explain the value of that I really believe this has been kind of a trick. But the bigger one of these projects becomes, it doesn't just cost money to run it. I mean, as you accumulate more and more podcast archives, and you need more bandwidth and you need more storage. But the biggest part of the equation, I think, is really time.
Oh yeah, I don't think people fully appreciate, unless they've done some kind of activism or some kind of, like me and you both do podcasting. I don't think people really appreciate the amount of time that we put into it. And that's not a labor theory of value argument. I put so much labor into this, so therefore I deserve to get paid.
Right. Absolutely.
But yeah, it's incredibly time consuming to record these, to plot them out, to go back and edit them. I know that you are one of the, as far as like my show, I just throw it up live. I start the recorder, I go live for an hour, I mix it down, and it's ready to go. You go back and you meticulously edit out a lot of stuff to get the most concise, powerful message possible. And I think that just from listening, I can assume that you probably spend 2 or 3 times as much time editing than you actually do recording. So for what people actually hear, for the hour that they actually get to listen to, I'm assuming it's probably 5 to 10 hours worth of work to get that hour worth of content.
Yeah. And sometimes it compels me kind of unconsciously to make those labor theory of value type arguments. Like, hey, look, the last show was the equivalent of 1 full work week from the start of the production to posting it on December 29th. But people could be like, yeah, but it was about James Bond, you know, and I don't care about that. But there's an opportunity for gratitude there as well. I love my Podcast Masters Liberty Masterclass and making these mega productions out of whatever topic we choose. And I am afforded the luxury, thanks to the people who support this show, that I can devote 40 hours to one show that I think in the end was extraordinary. I was really, really satisfied with that production when it was done. But yeah, it was about James Bond. So it doesn't have an objective value. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. So it's really what I want to stress there is that I'm grateful that I have the opportunity to do those things because of the people who've already stepped up and said, yeah, this is worth $6, $9, $12 a month to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one thing that you should be proud of is the fact that you do have an audience that finds your work valuable enough to return value to you. And going back to the welfare libertarian theme, there are some people that do just inundate their message with donate, donate, donate. And I think that one of the things that I really find valuable about your work is that you don't do that. I don't even know if you even have a donate button on your website. I know that personally, I don't have a donate button on my website. And that was a personal decision that I made. But the way that you have gone about doing it by saying, hey, if you find this valuable and you want to show me that you find it valuable, here's the way to do it. And I think that you should be very proud of the fact that you've been able to turn School Sucks Project into what it has become. And a lot of people are not able to take their passions and monetize them the way that you do. And the fact that you have is, to me, evidence that you are providing a lot of value for people out there.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that sincerely. And it also brings us to today's topic.
I am ready.
So I wanted to put down some terms first. And you posted this just the other day in the School Sucks group. You recently did a podcast, How to Set and Accomplish Your Goals in 2016. And you provided 10 tips in this show. And I also asked the group, what either methods or apps do you use to set and track goals? And we might incorporate some of that into the conversation as well. But I thought before we get into the list, we could just talk about some of the language that we're going to be using. First of all, goal is something that we're trying to achieve. But I would also use the word, you know, project or objective as synonyms there. Do you have any problems with that or any comments on that?
Nope, those actually are totally in line with each other, so I agree with that.
Yeah, because I mean, if you are familiar with getting things done, most of the work we do is organized into the completion of projects. Now, David Allen does talk about, you know, having that runway vision of your life, but as far as the day-to-day task-to-task work, most of what we're focusing on is, you know, formulating a project, outlining and defining a project, understanding why that project is compelling, and then working through step by step in the achievement or the completion of that project, which is essentially the achievement of a goal. The second one, milestone. This is an important one, a marker that indicates a kind of progress towards a larger goal. So we could also call that a sub-goal.
Yeah, kind of like a little point that helps you mark your progress towards the eventual goal.
Absolutely. And related to milestones, as we kind of work our way down to smaller pieces, tasks, individual actions that we take that move us closer towards a goal or a milestone. Now, in your podcast on this subject, you talked about next action. What are next actions?
Well, next actions come directly from getting things done and also from, I don't know if you're familiar with the book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, but Stephen Covey in that book, he talks about starting with the end in mind and working your way backwards. A lot of times we get focused on something that's way, way out there. And it's really easy to lose focus of how to get there if we don't know what our next action to get there is. So if we say, my goal is this way off in the distance, but we haven't worked backwards to what the next immediate action to actually get there is, it can just stay out there and never be worked towards at all.
Right, because there's nothing connecting it to the now, essentially.
Exactly.
All right, and that brings us to the last term that's probably going to be thrown around quite a bit in the show today, habit. Something that a person does often in the same way. Habits are not usually an end in themselves. They are a way to achieve a goal, We can also use words like rituals, disciplines, or practices. Now, of course, unfortunately, habits can also be bad. Right?
Yeah, habits, if left unchecked, habits can completely, they will overtake your life. And if you're conscious about creating your habits, then your life will go in one direction. But if you become a victim of your habits, your life will definitely go in the opposite direction.
As you transformed what you were doing over the last couple of years, did you find that a lot of your habits had to change or be thrown out and new habits had to be formed, I'm sure? But talk a little bit about that process for you.
I'll say this. It's an ever-evolving process. I still struggle with certain habits. I don't want to give the impression that I've mastered the art of habit making, because I definitely have not. But yeah, consciously taking on my habits and saying, this is going to be my morning routine from now on, and forcing myself through it. And it gets easier, but there's always room for improvement. But if you don't, then just like you mentioned, negative habits are habits as well. And if you allow yourself to fall into habits that have a destructive nature, you will have a very destructive outcome from it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Michael Hyatt,
yeah,
he said on Understanding the Truth About Our Habits, they always represent past successes. You have formed habitual, automatic behaviors because you once dealt with something successfully, tried the same response next time, and found it worked again. That's how habits grow and why they feel so useful. To get away from what's causing you unhappiness and workplace blues, you must give up many of your most fondly held and formerly successful habits and try new ways of thinking and acting. There truly isn't any alternative. Those habits are going to block you from finding new and creative ideas. No new ideas, no learning, no learning, no access to successful change. You know, one of the reasons why that really resonated with me is that it occurred to me in the context of what I do, midway through 2015, that I've been doing this show, School Sucks, for 6 years. A lot of the things that I do are exactly the same as the way I did them in 2009 when I started doing this show, in a rapidly expanding and evolving type of media. I have some habits that are 6 years old, and that was a real wake up for me to start seeing, well, all right, how can I shake things up a little bit? You know, a lot of it, we're going to talk about this too. A lot of it is comfort, right?
Yeah. And that actually can be the death of an organization or a dream. We see this in the business world a lot, where a business becomes successful based off of one type of practice, and then some sort of disruptive technology comes in and shakes things up. And because they're so stuck in the habit that at one time led to their success, and they refuse to adopt the new technology, or they refuse to adapt to the change in the marketplace, and they are so comfortable with the way that things have always been done, a lot of times they'll go to legislators and petition for regulations to stop the new technology, or they'll go to them and try and get basically outlaw the new things that might force them to change their habits, and they become dinosaurs and they end up going the way of the dinosaurs. So sometimes a habit that does lead to a positive outcome at one point in time, as things change, that same habit can become destructive. So it's always a good idea to go back and reevaluate your habits and say, are they still having the same positive outcome that they were before? Because if you don't, we've seen multiple companies, and we're watching it right now, technology is just exploding and completely shaking up the chessboard. And companies that refuse to adapt and refuse to change those habits that worked 20 years ago but no longer are viable, those companies are falling apart left and right.
Yeah, and confronting experience for me around the same time that you know, I was thinking about the way things have been done around this office for the last 6 years, as I was trying to formulate basically a 5-year plan or some long-term goals, like one of the higher altitudes in David Allen's metaphor, I asked myself, well, wait a minute, is podcasting going to be around in 2021? I'm not sure. I can't guarantee that it is. It reminded me of this story, and it relates to what you're saying as well, that my dad told me, I think when I was like a teenager, and he called it market myopia. And, you know, you talk about today with this huge government and all of these open hands and lobbying. There's a lot of people who are comfortable in a certain industry and they're pressing for more regulations. But there was a day when all of that didn't exist and people just went broke. And that was the case with a lot of the people who made fortunes in the railroad business. When the automobile came to be, they didn't understand that, hey, if we want to continue to be successful, we have to realize we are in the transportation business. And they said, no, we're in the railroad business. So for me to tell myself that I'm in the podcast business, that's going to have a finite life, because even if podcasting does continue to exist for a few more years, you have to look down the path a little bit further and say someday something is going to replace this most likely.
Yeah. And I think that in your particular case and in my particular case, podcasting is a big part of what we do. But I think the content generation and the education is really the businesses that we're in. And so as new tools emerge to provide that, if we stay stuck and say we're podcasters and that's how we get our message out there, then that could be very detrimental to our survival. But if we say, no, we're educators and we're content creators, and as new tools come out, we're going to find which ones work and help us accomplish those goals, then we will be able to succeed and continue doing what we do. So don't get stuck on what worked yesterday, because it might not work tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely. And podcast is just a means of delivery, basically. That's the way that I started to think about it. So let's transition into talking about some mistakes that we've both made, Nathan. We're going to provide 10 tips for listeners when it comes to setting goals and maybe even talking about some of the tools that we use. But goal setting mistakes first. I would say my biggest mistake has been not setting them at all. Not, you know, not looking forward into the future. And certainly, you know, as a result of that, not writing anything down, you know, not having any kind of regular thing that I'm checking in on to say, oh, that's something that I'm working on, or having some kind of system. It's not this way with projects. I mean, I do use the getting things done system for, you know, establishing or formulating and then ultimately completing a project. But bigger goals, life goals, long-term goals, I've always really, I hate to say it, but I've just never really thought that way. And, you know, I think a part of it, and this is really just a part of it, was being an employee for so long. And the way that I was an employee in a school, I used to write IEPs, individual education plans for students, and those had goals on them. And those goals were bullshit, you know? And I think goals developed a really negative connotation for me because of that. I was also just in this position as an employee where if I just kept showing up to work slowly and slowly, I would make more and more money, you know? So it seemed like other people were basically writing the script of my work life for me. So goals has always just been at best kind of abstract, like long-term goals. And honestly, something that has had a negative connotation attached to it.
For me, in my goals, I've always been a very goal-oriented person. I have always set goals for myself. I think my biggest weakness, and I still struggle with this today, is a lot of times my nature, especially as kind of having that entrepreneurial gene, my nature is to set a goal and then just jump into it and not really give too much consideration as to how I'm going to accomplish it. So I've always been kind of the guy that jumps off of the building and tries to figure out how to build a parachute on the way down. And hopefully I'll figure it out before I hit the ground. So that's always been one of my big things, is I will set goals, and I'm learning to change this about the way I go about approaching my goals, but just jumping in and not having a full plan before. And obviously you can't say I'm not going to start the car until every light is green to get to my destination. But at the same time, it does make sense to kind of plot out your course to get there before you start the car. So I think for me, my biggest weakness and the biggest reason that I've failed on some of my goals is I jumped into them and didn't really have a clear, I had an idea of where I wanted to go, but I didn't have a really clear understanding of how to get there or what it would entail. And a lot of times I got to the three quarters way mark and realized that I really wasn't into that goal, or the goal wasn't going to work the way that I thought it would originally. And had I gone back and done a little bit more planning in the beginning, I would have either realized that this is not a goal worth pursuing, or there's a much better way to pursue this goal. And so those are the things that I try to implement now. And I've noticed that throughout my life, kind of going back and examining which goals have paid off for me and which ones have blown up in my face. That's kind of the common theme, is the ones that I actually did give a lot of thought to before I jumped into. Those are the ones that usually I was able to accomplish them, or once I got to the end point, they actually ended up having a bigger payoff.
Yeah, I want to ask you for specific examples in a second, but you know, it sounds like you have really successfully managed a fear of failure, which is something that I haven't done, right? Like, I think that failure looms over me in this way that makes me uncomfortable. But the added thing here is that this is a kind of public failure, right? This is, everybody gets to see you fail. If you state what you're trying to do and then you can't do it, or I can't do it. And for the people who've listened closely, I mean, they've probably heard me say realistically 10 to 20 things that I'm going to do that ultimately did not happen. Now, one of the ways that I tried to formulate what would happen in 2016 on School Sucks podcast, and I put some thought into this before I ultimately decided on theme months, was 12 things that I'm willing to fail at publicly this year. That was one of the ideas that I had, because obviously setting goals and sticking to goals and achieving goals was something that was very, very important for this year, what I'm hoping will be the best year ever, not just of my life, but also of this pursuit. And getting over that fear of failure is something that I put a lot of thought into. So when you talk this way, metaphorically, about jumping off a building and figuring out how to build a parachute on the way down, why do you not have this fear of failure that I have? I mean, there's lots of reasons for that, but what do you make of that?
Well, I do have the fear of failure. It's not something that I'm not affected by. It's just too many times in my life, I've looked back and said, oh, if I only had the courage to go about and do that. And I realized early on, probably in my mid-teens to late teens, I realized that fear, typically the fear of something is way worse than the actual outcome is. And even if you do fail at something, fear of failure is usually worse than the actual failure itself. So I just early on in life, I realized that fear was one of the things that was holding me back. And I decided to consciously make a habit to do things that I was afraid of. And I realized I not just for me, I saw so many people that have all these great ideas or lofty ambitions that never act on them because of their fear, because typically it is fear of failure. They don't want to be humiliated. They don't want to look weak. They don't want to have that. I guess maybe it goes back to the tribe mentality. We don't want to look weak or unaccomplished in front of the tribe. But if you don't even try, which is the comfortable way to go about doing it, you have to think of yourself that way. And I would rather have other people think of me that way than have to look in the mirror and look at myself that way. So just early on, I decided if I'm afraid of something, that's something that I need to go full on towards rather than tucking it away and hiding it. And for me, in particular, in my own life, it's been beneficial, but I definitely don't lack that fear in any way whatsoever.
That fear is healthy and normal. And when you're experiencing that fear, that's actually probably a good sign. And that's going to come up when we get to our list of goal setting tips as well. I think for me, that fear has translated into having goals that aren't large enough or specific enough. Having goals that aren't measurable is also related to that.
The other thing is I do fail a lot. I set probably 30 times as many goals as most people do, and I fail at maybe 2/3 of them sometimes. But that 1/3 that I succeed at, those are the ones that people actually focus on. So yeah, I've set lots of goals. I started working on a video game with somebody a couple years back. That didn't end up panning out. I've worked on comic books. Those didn't end up panning out. I'm still dabbling with writing a children's book about the virtues of voluntarism. that has not come to fruition yet. But things like doing Anarchopreneur, things like setting up a mastermind group, there's other things in my life that I have succeeded at, and those are the things that I'm known for. So I have failed a lot. I still get fear of the failures, but the more goals you set, you might not succeed at a lot of them, but you will succeed at a lot more just based off of a ratio or a numbers game. And that's what people are going to know you for, is your successes.
I would like to think about it that way. And I feel like I have set, at least related to what I've done in the last 6 years, I have set a lot of goals, or like I said, created a lot of projects that were completed that I felt were very successful. You know, I wake up in the morning sometimes with this sense that I've never done anything, you know, and that gets me, and that gets me to my desk, and it gets me to my Evernote, and it gets me to my inbox, and it gets me to this microphone. But, you know, you're saying something valuable here that might help me reframe how I look at all of this. That's kind of motivating. I mean, I don't get up and say, oh, God, I'm a failure. I've never done anything. But I think it might be more of this orientation towards there's so much to do, and not resting on my laurels. I found when I was an employee, that made me lazy. Like, I would do something and get a whole bunch of appreciation and recognition from superiors at work in education, and then I could kind of coast on that for a while. And so I'm actually glad that that doesn't happen as much with the show. But no, as I'm saying that, I do coast sometimes. Like, I'll go back and I'll look at our archives, and I'll be like, gosh, I'm just picking this month completely arbitrarily because I could have totally killed it in this month. But July 2013, wow, I really just coasted through that month. But is there a way, I guess that story leads to this question, is there a way that you try to maintain gratitude or maintain a kind of consciousness about what you have achieved or are achieving?
This is something that me and you were talking about off of the air. I think in our last mastermind group, we were talking about this. The 5-minute journal has something in it that every morning it tells you to list 3 things that you're grateful for in your life. And I think that looking back and having a sense of gratitude, it can be crazy looking forward and looking at all the challenges and all the things that you still need to overcome. And it can be overwhelming to the point where it can almost make you just want to give up. But looking at the things that you have accomplished, you say it gives you like a sense of just kind of skating through or whatever. But for me, I think that's important. It's important to look back and say, these are the things that I have accomplished, because it gives you, or maybe I don't want to say it gives you, but it gives me more coal for the fire to keep moving forward.
Yeah, that even works on kind of a micro scale as well. Like, when there's a really large project, even like a podcast or a series of podcasts, and I'll procrastinate. I don't do this as much as I used to. I actually started 2015 with a series about procrastination where I tried to work through some of my own problems and make it useful to other people. But I used to really find that it was very difficult to start something. But once it began, you know, once I got the first 20 minutes recorded, the first half hour recorded, this momentum built that allowed me to speed through most of the rest of the project, you know, to suddenly go from a half an hour to much more than a half an hour. And then at the end, it kind of slows down again as you're trying to fine tune and shape everything perfectly and really, or maybe that's just me. That's just the way I work. But it's very slow in the beginning. The middle all happens very quickly. And then there's this slowness or caution again at the end. So having, you know, whether it's a small project or a large project, some success behind you is a great motivator to move forward, I think.
Yeah, and sometimes with life in general, or just with one specific goal in general, I'll kind of tie this back into something that most people can relate to. You walk into a messy kitchen, and there's dishes, and it needs to be mopped and swept, and the stove needs to be wiped down. And you look at all of it, and you're just like, oh my God, where do I start? And you go to the living room and turn on the Xbox instead. Or you could say, okay, this is the most logical place to start. And I'm going to start by washing the dishes, or I'm going to start by sweeping the floor. But no, sweeping the floor doesn't make sense because I'm going to make mess when I'm washing the dishes. So maybe I should start with the dishes. Whatever. the situation is you pick one and you start there. And as soon as you're halfway done with that, you're like, oh, this is not nearly as bad as when I first walked into the house. So I guess it's just that thing where it's a big thing that you can procrastinate on. It's a big, giant goal that if you don't have clarity and if you haven't taken that first step, it's a lot more scary than it is once you've actually gotten a little bit of clarity about your plan and you know how you're going to move forward and you actually have started on it. Then all of a sudden, it starts to become a lot easier. And then, but yes, just like you said, that last 20% is sometimes a real struggle as well. You get almost all the way and then you start having self-doubt. Was it worth it? Is this really going to work? Now I'm going to have to release this and get the feedback. And then it gets scary again.
I don't know. No, you know, it's never that. That's hasn't been my experience. Like that struggle. I wouldn't even use the word struggle at the end. That slow, cautious part is filled with excitement. Like, okay, this is actually going to happen. We just have to make sure it's as good as it possibly can be. You know, it's the part for me, I guess everyone's different, but for me, it's the part at the beginning that sucks. And one of the things that really helped with that, of course, is again, getting things done and taking a project and turning it into an action list. So when you're talking about cleaning the house, this is something that I often have to deal with, having a checklist is magic. You know, I never believed people when they said, you know, right. My dad always used to tell me to write down a list of everything you need to do, make an itinerary, all that. I just thought he was, OCD. but there is something so satisfying. I do this in Evernote every day. I have a note called or a notebook called Today. And it says today, review every 7 days. And every morning that is going to be the plan for the day. So every morning I paste a morning routine that has every single thing, no matter how mundane, that I need to get done in the morning every day. And I check. Evernote has a thing for that. Each one off one by one. And I find that I have a great momentum for the rest of the day. That I really, really didn't nail the morning routine until December 2015. After building it up slowly, maybe going all the way back to March of last year, building it up slowly, adding things to it very gradually until it's a list with like, I'm going to do a show about it, but it has more than 10 items on it. And some of them can be done like that. Some of them, like the 5-minute journal, take a little bit more time, like 5 minutes. But even that is a pretty low time commitment. So yes, if I had a project, even like cleaning a whole house, or I remember building the studio was a checklist that I think had something like 100 items on it. As I see the accumulation of checks, I get very, very excited and motivated. And anytime anybody complains about anything that they have to do, my first thought is make a checklist.
Yeah,
of next actions. Clarify next actions. And sometimes when a project is really overwhelming, we don't even want to do that, though, you know, or a goal seems really, really hard to reach. That's been my experience, is that I don't want to write it down. And because that will lead to basically outlining what it takes to achieve it. But if I use all of these other lessons from cleaning the house and building the studio and going through a morning routine or completing a podcast master's or completing a podcast series, I know that that will ultimately pay off, that process.
Well, and it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, where the fear is usually worse than the actual reality of the situation.
Yeah. No one cares when I fail, I've realized. Only I care. You know, there's plenty of other things distracting people. No one is like really laser focused on my failures, except me.
True. Yeah. True. But, you know, when I look back at, because I've been a longtime listener of your show and a longtime fan of your work, when I look back, I can't even think of a single time where I'm like, oh, Brett totally failed there. I can think of all these times where you've succeeded, though. That's when I look at you. Some of the things that you've said in this conversation so far are not consistent with the way that I've built you up in my mind. So that's right there is evidence that people really focus on what you succeed at, and the things that you fail at don't really have that big of an impact on the people around you and the way that they view you.
Absolutely. Yeah, that would make more sense that I'm the one, you know, when I look in the mirror, I'm seeing something different than what other people are seeing. That's good to know. That's comforting. Before we move on to the next thing, Nathan, can I ask for an example of that? I'm curious. Something that I said that was inconsistent with your vision of me? in this discussion?
Yeah, you've mentioned a couple times that you look back at things and that you are, you don't have like this sense of success about them, or you feel like you've kind of slid on that success and not had the motivation to keep going at the same output level or whatever. Or just in general, you've kind of talked about how you don't feel like you've accomplished very much or you haven't had your goals in line. I look at School Sucks Project as you're constantly one of the top performing podcasts on, is it Podomatic or is it, where do you host it?
Podomatic is where it's hosted.
Yeah. So you're constantly one of the top performing there. You're constantly top performing in iTunes. You're one of the few libertarian type podcasts that has successfully carved out your own niche, because, and I've heard you talk about this before, the marketplace for libertarian podcasts is kind of flooded, and you're one of the few that has carved yourself out a niche. You're one of the few that has been around since way before libertarian podcasts were even popular, and you're still going strong. You have accomplished to do what 99% of the other libertarian podcasters out there strive for. And I don't think that you, at least throughout this conversation, you haven't really come across as realizing how much of an accomplishment that actually is.
And, you know, I think that doing that exercise in the 5-minute journal, first of all, thank you so much for saying that. The grin on my face while you went through that. And you're saying things that I do know, right? And I don't think about regularly enough. But that makes me so happy to hear you say that, especially as a longtime listener. Doing that exercise of just writing down three things that I'm grateful for in that journal that's part of my morning routine every morning has made a big difference. And I think maybe I have more of a negative orientation here because we're discussing the problems that we're still having. And it is still a problem. But every single day when I make that list of three things, one or two of them is related to what I'm doing for a career. So it's definitely become more and more a part of my conscious process every day. But I really appreciate you saying that. And, you know, all of that, when I gather it up and I remember to be grateful, that, again, is the momentum that I need to make 2016 great.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would just say, for the listeners out there, we've mentioned the 5-minute journal. If you don't know what the 5-minute journal is, go check it out. I got myself a copy of it, a few months back, probably midsummer of this year, and it's filled up. It's almost filled up. I need to definitely order another one. But in this world full of applications and digital technology to help us set our goals, the 5-minute journal is like an actual tangible 5-minute journal. And it's been one of my best tools as far as really focusing in on where I'm going in life, where I want to be going in life. And it's so simple. It takes 5 minutes in the morning and 5 minutes at night. And the impact that it has is just unmeasurable.
Yeah, I've really found it to be helpful as well. And, you know, there's something really helpful about writing things down by hand.
Oh, yeah.
I've become a real post-it note guy as well. Lots of post-it notes like all over my desk. and there's a system. And, you know, in writing goals down, handwriting goals down. And then even if they're just handwritten somewhere, a lot of it happens like on a daily goal basis in that 5-minute journal. I think one of the items is how to make, you know, today great, right? Something similar to that. But I was doing everything in Evernote for a while. And eventually I just realized that if I had a really great handwritten note, I could snap a photo of it and throw it in Evernote.
Yeah. So. And the way that I use Evernote is more of a idea collector or a place to capture ideas. Mm-hmm. So I always have my phone on me. And if I have an idea for a podcast or if I have an idea for some sort of way to monetize something, I put it down in Evernote. But as far as actually listing out my goals, definitely handwritten.
Yeah. And trying to make them visible. So what I did was I wrote them all on post-it notes, right? Just what the goal was. And then it becomes basically a project in Evernote, which I have a system for. So I have them pasted across the top of my desk right here. And then I went and, you know, we're going to talk about how many goals a person should have at, or what's realistic to have at one time. But I found a little image on a Google image search of post-it notes on a bulletin board. And I found one with four of them, which is how many large goals I have related to School Sucks for 2016. Now, of course, there are sub-goals for each large goal, but I just went into Photoshop and wrote what each goal was on each one of these post-it notes and made it the desktop background on my computer.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. So I see them every day, and it's on the computer that I use to do the show and on my laptop, and I'll probably move it to my phone as well. So in the background, every day, these goals will be visible. I experimented for a while with a folder in Evernote as one of the post-it notes sticky stuff fails and it falls. Oh, how ironic. Hold on, putting this one back up. This is the most. This actually happens to be the most ambitious one of all that I'm pressing into my desk right now. But I experimented with a notebook stack in Evernote related to goals. Like, it was SSP goals this week, SSP goals this month, SSP goals this year, and then same thing with personal goals: a week, month, year. But I just never really made anything out of that, because it could just be tucked away in a notebook. I could collapse the notebook stack and just see this little thing that said goals. And of all the other things that I'm juggling in Evernote, you know, David Allen talks about, you know, the attention going to the latest and the loudest. And I still feel like that's been kind of an issue for me, you know, that there's always something that needs to get done. There's always another podcast that needs to be put out every 4 days, every 5 days, at most every 7 days. And I can always procrastinate by not prioritizing. You know what I mean? I can always direct my attention to this thing that has to be done now, or that I tell myself this thing has to be done now. And that's how longer goals, bigger visions have kind of fallen by the wayside.
Yeah, it goes back to the analogy I said earlier, where you walk in and you look at the kitchen and you say, you know, I really could go beat my high score on the Xbox right now.
But can you tell yourself the same story with the Xbox? Because, like, all right, so here's an example. I had to write the introduction for the new edition of the Underground History of American Education, Gatto's book. And this was something I was working on a lot in November. But there's always another podcast that needed to be done, right? So I hate writing. And this is another mistake I would make. I would say things like, I'm not a writer. I hate writing. Then I would sit down and try to write. But, you know, after a half hour, I could find a really kind of empty distraction, like going to Facebook. But there was this nice comforting story that I had for myself. If I said, no, you know what? I really got to get this show out by Friday, and I can redirect my attention that way for now. So I think there's ways around this we're going to talk about in this list. But do you think that somebody could find something like beating a high score on an Xbox game to be as compelling as the thing they actually need to get done?
Not somebody like me or you, but right. Yeah, definitely other people. One thing that I find that kind of dovetails on what you just said, if I've got two things that I know need to get done, one of them is I've got to get some tax paperwork filed or an incorporation paperwork filed, and I have to get a logo done. And I hate, like, not just because it's not my strong suit, but just because it goes against my fundamental nature to ask the government for permission to do business. I really hate doing incorporation type paperwork.
Yeah.
So if I know I have both of them on my plate for the day, typically, and this is something I have to fight myself with, I'll go and I'll start working on Photoshop. And then the next day I run out of excuses and I'm like, okay, I have to go get this paperwork filed today. But yeah, when I've got two things and I know one of them is more of a priority, but the other one is more in line with what I'm comfortable doing, I do sometimes find myself doing the one that's more comfortable at the expense of the one that's more important.
Absolutely. That's it. That's the problem. Right? Because sometimes things, like, we attach importance to urgency in a way that isn't accurate.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, because of procrastination or the lack of prioritization, the lack of the ability, being able to start things slowly and plan accordingly, that often happens, that attachment of urgency to importance. Let's pause for a second. I want to pull up that David Allen matrix. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
Is it from the Getting Things Done?
Yeah, it's definitely from Getting Things Done.
More than likely. I've read Getting Things Done, I think, twice through, but so much information in there, I get lost on things sometimes.
All right. So self-management matrix, he calls it. And I'm going to put a link to this in the show notes. And I'll put the image in the show notes as well. The Y up and down axis, in case we have any listeners who haven't had algebra yet, is perspective. The x-axis is control. So as we go from top to bottom on the y-axis, it's low to high. And on the x-axis, as we go from left to right, it's low to high. So there's four quadrants that you can wind up in. If you have low perspective and low control, you're basically working as a victim or as a responder. And I would even change responder to a reactor. Right. So that's the crazy quadrant that I'm talking about, where urgency defines importance. You know, this needs to get done. And I think a lot of people work that way. I mean, that was certainly how I learned to work in school, doing everything last minute. It was the only way I knew how to work. So that's low perspective, low control, which obviously, school is the perfect environment for having neither of those things available to you. High perspective, low control. So this is the quadrant above that. Is what he calls the crazy maker or the visionary, right? You're not realizing what needs to be done right now. So a lot of your attention wanders off into these visionary pursuits, things that are compelling and exciting, but really don't serve any purpose or goal that you're currently should be focused on. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And I find myself in that quadrant very often, and it's a struggle to work my way out of it.
Well, if we cross down to low perspective, high control, that's called the micromanager or the implementer, right? So the implementer, somebody who's always starting things but not finishing them, or the micromanager, somebody who is losing a bunch of his or her time in projects that really don't contribute. It's a waste of time considering what the vision is, basically. So that's low perspective, high control, needing to have your hands in everything. But high perspective, high control is what he calls captain and commander, which is essentially where you want to be. You know what needs to be done, and you know how to do it.
For me personally, I feel like I teeter back and forth between the top two. And sometimes I fall into the left, and sometimes if I'm very focused on what I'm doing, I fall into the right hand side. But the bottom two are not conducive with the way I try to live my life.
Yeah, absolutely. The bottom two really remind me of the whole school experience, both as a student and as a teacher.
And the bottom two also very much remind me of corporate America, and being that our modern education system was structured around plugging people into corporate America, I think that's the reason why there's the overlap there.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that as well. And I will say, just on a final note on this self-management matrix, some of the best work that I think I've done, some of the things that I'm proudest of, happened in the crazy maker quadrant, for sure. Just impulsively deciding to do something and then getting so sucked into it as I started to make progress with it, that I couldn't, it started like, oh, here's a great idea. Maybe I'll just try it. I'll play around with this for a while. But then I had played around with it so long that I could see this pile that I had made, or this thing that I had started to build, that I was just so compelled to have to continue with it. Like a lot of the video stuff that I've done, I think would be examples of that.
Yeah. Oftentimes I'll start in the left-hand quadrant, and if it's worth it, I'll force myself into the top right-hand quadrant.
Mm. But having systems, you know, a lot of times, like being organized through something like getting things done, or even understanding the trivium, or even in a bigger way, having the philosophy of liberty as kind of the anchor point in a mind map, you can often figure out how some crazy maker excursion actually fits into Captain and Commander, right? Because there's a reason why there's a reason why I want to impulsively do something. There's something in my subconscious that, you know, fires that into my thought process and makes it so compelling that I say, I'm going to try to start playing around with this thing. And I've often found like, oh, no, wait a minute. Why didn't I think about that? That makes perfect sense. That perfectly fits into what I'm actually trying to do as a larger vision here. But it just didn't, as I'm trying to organize what my vision is, a lot of times I think creative thought suffers in that organizational process. So sometimes it's nice to be able to, and I think David Allen says as much in one of his TED Talks, it's nice to have a space or the time or the freedom to make a creative mess. Because if you have you know, a system for how you produce or how you stay organized, and obviously a larger, you know, philosophy in which you operate. Sometimes that crazy excursion is actually meeting a need that you didn't realize that you had, or it's the means for meeting a need you didn't realize when you had just defined the need. But later you can find a way to make it fit in to the larger vision. To be continued. I'm a basket bearing, bike riding, bell ringing, rhymes to you home. It is hard to be a gangster, gangster. With the basket on your bike, it is hard to be a gangster, gangster. With the basket on your bike, it is hard to be a gangster, gangster. With the basket on your bike, it is hard to be a gangster, 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 gangster. New subscriber, geography, trivia. He just saw your person's name. That is roughly 7 million. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to New Subscriber Geography Trivia. I think by now most people understand what this is. The name actually provides quite a fair amount of information. But somebody signs up to support the show, and then I share some trivia about that place. So it's a way to say thank you for the person who signed up, but also educate the rest of you on towns like Greencastle, Indiana. That's where we're going today. Our new subscriber is Daniel C. Thank you for signing up, Daniel. Let's talk about Greencastle, Indiana. Have you ever heard of John Dillinger? He was a very, very famous gangster and bank robber. Dillinger was one of the most famous robber gangster types of the Great Depression outlaw era. He was joined by people like Babyface Nelson, Pretty Boy Floyd, and of course, Bonnie and Clyde. Dillinger was a kind of prototypical celebrity gangster. He liked publicity. He fancied himself a kind of Robin Hood figure. And he became so popular with the public, his gang and its activities actually provided J. Edgar Hoover with the impetus for developing a more sophisticated crime-fighting tool to address the growing organized crime issue in the United States of America. That tool was called the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Hoover actually used Dillinger and his gang as a kind of marketing for the development of the FBI. The biggest heist of John Dillinger's career happened at the Central National Bank in Greencastle, Indiana. On Monday, October 23rd, 1933, Dillinger, just 30 years old at the time, entered the Central National Bank in Greencastle with three other armed men, and they escaped with $74,782.09. Don't forget your 9 cents, they said to Dillinger. On a final note, it's estimated that in Dillinger's entire criminal career, he stole around $500,000. That is roughly $7 million today. But Hoover's FBI would invest a total of $2 million dollars in trying to catch Dillinger. When that amount is adjusted for inflation, it is, in today's money, $35.4 million. That's more than five times what Dillinger and his gang stole in the first place. Hey, Hoover, you suck.
New subscriber, geography, trivia.